Surprises work both ways. I explained in my introduction to Nightfall that its success had been completely unexpected. Well, in the case of Strikebreaker, I thought I had a blockbuster. It seemed to me to be fresh and original. I felt it contained a stirring sociological theme with lots of meaning and with considerable pathos. Yet, as nearly as I can make out, it dropped silently into the sea of audience reaction without as much as marking out a single circular ripple on its surface. But I can be stubborn about such things. If I like a story, I like it, and I include it here to give the audience a second chance. This is one of those stories where I can remember the exact occasion that put it into my mind. It involved one of my periodic trips to New York, which have more and more become a kind of highlight to my life. They are the only occasions on which I can stop writing for as much as 3 or 4 days at a time without feeling either guilty or restless. Naturally, anything that would tend to interfere with one of my trips would ruffle my otherwise imperturbable sang-froid. Actually, I would throw a fit. It was bad enough when something enormous would get in my way, a hurricane or a blizzard, for instance, but a subway strike? And not of all the subway employees, but only a few key men, say 35. They would stall the entire subway system, and with that, the entire city. And if the strike came to pass, I could scarcely venture into a stalled city. Where will this all end? I apostrophized the heavens in my best tragical manner, one fist raised high and the other clenched in my hair. A mere handful of men can paralyze an entire megalopolis. Where will it end? My gesture remained frozen as, in thought, I carried the situation to its logical extreme. I carefully unhooked the gesture, went upstairs, and wrote Strikebreaker. The happy ending is that the threatened strike did not come to pass, and I went to New York. One more point about this story. It represents my personal record for stupid title changes. The editor of the magazine in which this story first appeared was Robert W. Lowndes, as sweet and as erudite a man as I have ever known. He had nothing to do with it. Some idiot in the higher echelons decided to call the story Male Strikebreaker. Why male? What possible addition to the sense of the title can be made by that adjective? What illumination? What improvement? Heavens, I can understand, though not approve, a ridiculous title change which the publisher felt would imply something salacious and thus increase sales. But the modified title doesn't even do that. Oh well, I'll just change it back. First appearance, the original science fiction stories, January 1957, under the title Male Strikebreaker. Copyright 1956 by Columbia Publications, Incorporated. Strikebreaker. Elvis Bly rubbed his plump hands and said, "Self-containment is the word." He smiled uneasily as he helped Stephen Lamarack of Earth to alight. There was uneasiness all over his smooth face with its small, wide-set eyes. Lamarack puffed smoke appreciatively and crossed his lanky legs. His hair was powdered with gray, and he had a large and powerful jawbone. "Homegrown?" he asked, staring critically at the cigarette. He tried to hide his own disturbance at the other's tension. "Quite," said Bly. "No wonder," said Lamarack, "that you have room on your small world for such luxuries." Lamarack thought of his first view of Elsevier from the spaceship visiplate. It was a jagged, airless planetoid some 100 miles in diameter, just a dust-gray, rough-hewn rock glimmering dully in the light of its sun, 200 million miles distant. It was the only object more than a mile in diameter that circled that sun, and now men had burrowed into that miniature world and constructed a society in it, and he himself, as a sociologist, had come to study the world and see how humanity had made itself fit into that queerly specialized niche. Bly's polite, fixed smile expanded a hair. He said, "We are not a small world, Dr. Lamarack. You judge us by two-dimensional standards. The surface area of Elsevier is only 3/4 that of the state of New York, but that's irrelevant. Remember, we can occupy, if we wish, the entire interior of Elsevier. A sphere of 50 miles radius has a volume of well over 500,000 cubic miles. If all of Elsevier were occupied by levels 50 feet apart, the total surface area within the planetoid would be 56 million square miles, and that is equal to the total land area of Earth. And none of these square miles, Doctor, would be unproductive. Lamoureux said, "Good Lord," and stared blankly for a moment. "Yes, of course you're right. Strange, I never thought of it that way. But then, Elsevier is the only thoroughly exploited planetoid world in the galaxy. The rest of us simply can't get away from thinking of two-dimensional surfaces, as you pointed out. Well, I'm more than ever glad that your council has been so cooperative as to give me a free hand in this investigation of mine." Bly nodded convulsively at that. Lamoureux frowned slightly and thought, "He acts for all the world as though he wished I had not come. Something's wrong." Bly said, "Of course, you understand that we are actually much smaller than we could be. Only minor portions of Elsevier have as yet been hollowed out and occupied. Nor are we particularly anxious to expand, except very slowly. To a certain extent, we are limited by the capacity of our pseudo-gravity engines and solar energy converters." "I understand. But tell me, Counselor Bly, as a matter of personal curiosity, and not because it is of prime importance to my project, could I view some of your farming and herding levels first? I'm fascinated by the thought of fields of wheat and herds of cattle inside a planetoid." "You'll find the cattle small by your standards, Doctor, and we don't have much wheat. We grow yeast to a much greater extent, but there will be some wheat to show you, some cotton and tobacco too, even fruit trees." "Wonderful. As you say, self-containment. You recirculate everything, I imagine." Lamoureux's sharp eyes did not miss the fact that this last remark twinged Bly. The Elsevierian's eyes narrowed to slits that hid his expression. He said, "We must recirculate, yes, air, water, food, minerals, everything that is used up must be restored to its original state. Waste products are reconverted to raw materials. All that is needed is energy, and we have enough of that. We don't manage with 100% efficiency, of course. There is a certain seepage. We import a small amount of water each year, and if our needs grow, we may have to import some coal and oxygen." Lamoureux said, "When can we start our tour, Counselor Bly?" Bly's smile lost some of its negligible warmth. "As soon as we can, Doctor. There are some routine matters that must be arranged." Lamoureux nodded, and having finished his cigarette, stubbed it out. "Routine matters?" There was none of this hesitancy during the preliminary correspondence. Elsevier had seemed proud that its unique planetoid existence had attracted the attention of the galaxy. He said, "I realize I would be a disturbing influence in a tightly knit society," and watched grimly as Bly leaped at the explanation and made it his own. "Yes," said Bly. "We feel marked off from the rest of the galaxy. We have our own customs. Each individual Elsevierian fits into a comfortable niche. The appearance of a stranger without fixed caste is unsettling." "The caste system does involve a certain inflexibility." "Granted," said Bly quickly, "but there is also a certain self-assurance. We have firm rules of intermarriage and rigid inheritance of occupation. Each man, woman, and child knows his place, accepts it, and is accepted in it. We have virtually no neurosis or mental illness." "And are there no misfits?" asked Lamoureux. Bly shaped his mouth as though to say no, then clamped it suddenly shut, biting the word into silence. A frown deepened on his forehead. He said at length, "I will arrange for the tour, Doctor. Meanwhile, I imagine you would welcome a chance to freshen up and to sleep." They rose together and left the room, Bly politely motioning the Earthman to precede him out the door. Lamoureux felt oppressed by the vague feeling of crisis that had pervaded his discussion with Bly. The newspaper reinforced that feeling. He read it carefully before getting into bed with what was at first merely a clinical interest. It was an 8-page tabloid of synthetic paper. 1/4 of its items consisted of personals: births, marriages, deaths, record quotas, expanding habitable volume, not area, 3 dimensions. The remainder included scholarly essays, educational material, and fiction. Of news, in the sense to which Lamoureux was accustomed, there was virtually nothing. 1 item only could be so considered, and that was chilling in its incompleteness. It said under a small headline, "Demands unchanged." There has been no change in his attitude of yesterday. The chief counselor, after a second interview, announced that his demands remain completely unreasonable and cannot be met under any circumstances. Then, in parentheses and in different type, there was the statement, "The editors of this paper agree that Elsevier cannot and will not jump to his whistle, come what may." Lamoureux read it over three times. His attitude. His demands. His whistle. Whose? He slept uneasily that night. He had no time for newspapers in the days that followed, but spasmodically the matter returned to his thoughts. Bly, who remained his guide and companion for most of the tour, grew ever more withdrawn. On the third day, quite artificially clock set in an Earth-like 24-hour pattern, Bly stopped at one point and said, "Now, this level is devoted entirely to chemical industries. That section is not important." But he turned away a shade too rapidly, and Lamoureux seized his arm. "What are the products of that section?" "Fertilizers, certain organics," said Bly stiffly. Lamoureux held him back, looking for what sight Bly might be evading. His gaze swept over the close-by horizons of lined rock and the buildings squeezed and layered between the levels. Lamoureux said, "Isn't that a private residence there?" Bly did not look in the indicated direction. Lamoureux said, "I think that's the largest one I've seen yet. Why is it here on a factory level?" That alone made it noteworthy. He had already seen that the levels on Elsevier were divided rigidly among the residential, the agricultural, and the industrial. He looked back and called, "Counselor Bly." The counselor was walking away, and Lamoureux pursued him with hasty steps. "Is there something wrong, sir?" Bly muttered. "I am rude, I know. I am sorry. There are matters that prey on my mind." He kept up his rapid pace. "Concerning his demands." Bly came to a full halt. "What do you know about that?" "No more than I've said. I read that much in the newspaper." Bly muttered something to himself. Lamoureux said, "Ragusnik? What's that?" Bly sighed heavily. "I suppose you ought to be told. It's humiliating, deeply embarrassing. The council thought that matters would certainly be arranged shortly, and that your visit need not be interfered with, that you need not know or be concerned. But it is almost a week now. I don't know what will happen, and appearances notwithstanding, it might be best for you to leave. No reason for an outworlder to risk death." The Earthman smiled incredulously. "Risk death? In this little world, so peaceful and busy, I can't believe it." The Elsevierian counselor said, "I can explain. I think it best I should." He turned his head away. "As I told you, everything on Elsevier must recirculate. You understand that?" "Yes." "That includes, human wastes." "I assumed so," said Lamoureux. "Water is reclaimed from it by distillation and absorption. What remains is converted into fertilizer for yeast use. Some of it is used as a source of fine organics and other byproducts. These factories, you see, are devoted to this." "Well," Lamoureux had experienced a certain difficulty in the drinking of water when he first landed on Elsevier, because he had been realistic enough to know what it must be reclaimed from. But he had conquered the feeling easily enough. Even on Earth, water was reclaimed by natural processes from all sorts of unpalatable substances. Bly, with increasing difficulties, said, "Igor Ragusnik is the man who is in charge of the industrial processes immediately involving the wastes. The position has been in his family since Elsevier was first colonized. One of the original settlers was Mikhail Ragusnik, and he was in charge of waste reclamation." "Yes." "Now that residence you singled out is the Ragusnik residence. It is the best and most elaborate on the planetoid. Ragusnik gets many privileges the rest of us do not have, but after all," passion entered the counselor's voice with great suddenness, "we cannot speak to him." "What?" "He demands full social equality. He wants his children to mingle with ours and our wives to visit." "Oh." It was a groan of utter disgust. Lamoureux thought of the newspaper item that could not even bring itself to mention Ragusnik's name in print or to say anything specific about his demands. He said, "I take it he's an outcast because of his job." "Naturally. human wastes and... Words failed Bly. After a pause, he said more quietly, "As an Earthman, I suppose you don't understand." "As a sociologist, I think I do." Lamarack thought of the untouchables in ancient India, the ones who handled corpses. He thought of the position of swineherds in ancient Judea. He went on, "I gather Elsevier will not give in to those demands." "Never," said Bly energetically, "never." "And so?" "Ragusnik has threatened to cease operations." "Go on strike, in other words." "Yes." "Would that be serious?" "We have enough food and water to last quite a while. Reclamation is not essential in that sense. But the wastes would accumulate. They would infect the planetoid. After generations of careful disease control, we have low natural resistance to germ diseases. Once an epidemic started, and one would, we would drop by the hundred." "Is Ragusnik aware of this?" "Yes, of course." "Do you think he is likely to go through with his threat, then?" "He's mad. He has already stopped working. There has been no waste reclamation since the day before you landed." Bly's bulbous nose sniffed at the air as though it already caught the whiff of excrement. Lamarack sniffed mechanically at that, but smelled nothing. Bly said, "So you see why it might be wise for you to leave. We are humiliated, of course, to have to suggest it." But Lamarack said, "Wait. Not just yet. Good Lord, this is a matter of great interest to me professionally. May I speak to the Ragusnik?" "On no account," said Bly, alarmed. "But I would like to understand the situation. The sociological conditions here are unique and not to be duplicated elsewhere. In the name of science, how do you mean speak?" "Would image reception do?" "Yes." "I will ask the council," muttered Bly. They sat about Lamarack uneasily, their austere and dignified expressions badly marred with anxiety. Bly, seated in the midst of them, studiously avoided the Earthman's eyes. The chief counselor, gray-haired, his face harshly wrinkled, his neck scrawny, said in a soft voice, "If in any way you can persuade him, sir, out of your own convictions, we will welcome that. In no case, however, are you to imply that we will in any way yield." A gauzy curtain fell between the council and Lamarack. He could make out the individual counselors still, but now he turned sharply toward the receiver before him. It glowed to life. A head appeared in it, in natural color and with great realism. A strong, dark head, with massive chin, faintly stubbled, and thick red lips set into a firm, horizontal line. The image said suspiciously, "Who are you?" Lamarack said, "My name is Stephen Lamarack. I am an Earthman."
"An Outworlder."
"That's right. I am visiting Elsevier. You are Ragusnik?"
"Igor Ragusnik at your service," said the image mockingly. "Except that there is no service and will be none until my family and I are treated like human beings."
Lamarack said, "Do you realize the danger that Elsevier is in? The possibility of epidemic disease?"
"In 24 hours, the situation can be made normal. If they allow me humanity, the situation is theirs to correct."
"You sound like an educated man, Ragusnik."
"So?"
"I am told you're denied of no material comforts. You are housed and clothed and fed better than anyone on Elsevier. Your children are the best educated."
"Granted, but all by servo mechanism. And motherless girl babies are sent us to care for until they grow to be our wives. And they die young for loneliness. Why?"
There was sudden passion in his voice.
"Why must we live in isolation as if we were all monsters unfit for human beings to be near? Aren't we human beings like others, with the same needs and desires and feelings? Don't we perform an honorable and useful function?"
There was a rustling of sighs from behind Lamarack. Ragusnik heard it and raised his voice.
"I see you of the council behind there. Answer me. Isn't it an honorable and useful function? It is your waste made into food for you. Is the man who purifies corruption worse than the man who produces it? Listen, counselors, I will not give in. Let all of Elsevier die of disease, including myself and my son, if necessary. But I will not give in. My family will be better dead of disease than living as now."
Lamarack interrupted. "You've led this life since birth, haven't you?"
"And if I have?"
"Surely you're used to it."
"Never. Resigned, perhaps. My father was resigned, and I was resigned for a while. But I have watched my son, my only son, with no other little boy to play with. My brother and I had each other, but my son will never have anyone, and I am no longer resigned. I am through with Elsevier, and through with talking. The receiver went dead. The chief counselors to an aged yellow. He and Bly were the only ones of the group left with Lamorak. The chief counselor said, "The man is deranged. I do not know how to force him." He had a glass of wine at his side. As he lifted it to his lips, he spilled a few drops that stained his white trousers with purple splotches. Lamorak said, "Are his demands so unreasonable? Why can't he be accepted into society?" There was momentary rage in Bly's eyes. "A dealer in excrement!" Then he shrugged. "You are from Earth." Incongruously, Lamorak thought of another unacceptable, one of the numerous classic creations of the medieval cartoonist Al Capp, the variously named Inside Man at the Skunk Works. He said, "Does Ragusnik really deal with excrement? I mean, is there physical contact? Surely it is all handled by automatic machinery." "Of course," said the chief counselor. "Then exactly what is Ragusnik's function?" "He manually adjusts the various controls that assure the proper functioning of the machinery. He shifts units to allow repairs to be made. He alters functional rates with the time of day. He varies end production with demand." He added sadly, "If we had the space to make the machinery 10 times as complex, all this could be done automatically, but that would be such needless waste." "But even so," insisted Lamorak, "all Ragusnik does, he does simply by pressing buttons or closing contacts or things like that." "Yes." "Then his work is no different from any Elsevierian's," Bly said stiffly. "You don't understand. And for that you will risk the death of your children?" "We have no other choice," said Bly. There was enough agony in his voice to assure Lamorak that the situation was torture for him, but that he had no other choice indeed. Lamorak shrugged in disgust. "Then break the strike. Force him." "How?" said the chief counselor. "Who would touch him or go near him? And if we kill him by blasting from a distance, how will that help us?" Lamorak said thoughtfully, "Would you know how to run his machinery?" The chief counselor came to his feet. "I?" he howled. "I don't mean you," cried Lamorak at once. "I used the pronoun in its indefinite sense. Could someone learn how to handle Ragusnik's machinery?" Slowly the passion drained out of the chief counselor. "It is in the handbooks, I'm certain, though I assure you I have never concerned myself with it." "Then couldn't someone learn the procedure and substitute for Ragusnik until the man gives in?" Bly said, "Who would agree to do such a thing? Not I, under any circumstances." Lamorak thought fleetingly of earthly taboos that might be almost as strong. He thought of cannibalism, incest, a pious man cursing God. He said, "But you must have made provision for vacancy in the Ragusnik job. Suppose he died. Then his son would automatically succeed to his job, or his nearest other relatives," said Bly. "What if he had no adult relatives? What if all his family died at once?" "That has never happened. It will never happen," the chief counselor added. "If there were danger of it, we might perhaps place a baby or two with the Ragusniks and have it raised to the profession." "Ah, and how would you choose that baby?" "From among children of mothers who died in childbirth, as we choose the future Ragusnik bride." "Then choose a substitute Ragusnik now, by lot," said Lamorak. The chief counselor said, "No, impossible. How can you suggest that? If we select a baby, that baby is brought up to the life. It knows no other. At this point, it would be necessary to choose an adult and subject him to Ragusnikhood." "No, Dr. Lamorak, we are neither monsters nor abandoned brutes." "No use," thought Lamorak helplessly. "No use unless..." He couldn't bring himself to face that unless just yet. That night, Lamorak slept scarcely at all. Ragusnik asked for only the basic elements of humanity, but opposing that were 30,000 Elsevierians who faced death. The welfare of 30,000 on one side, the just demands of one family on the other. Could one say that 30,000 who would support such injustice deserved to die? Injustice by what standards? Earth's? Elsevier's?
And who was Lamorak that he should judge? And Ragusnik? He was willing to let 30,000 die, including men and women who merely accepted a situation they had been taught to accept and could not change if they wished to, and children who had nothing at all to do with it. 30,000 on one side, a single family on the other. Lamorak made his decision in something that was almost despair. In the morning, he called the chief counselor. He said, "Sir, if you can find a substitute, Ragusnik will see that he has lost all chance to force a decision in his favor and will return to work." "There can be no substitute," sighed the chief counselor. "I've explained that." "No substitute among the Elsevierians, but I am not an Elsevierian. That doesn't matter to me. I will substitute." They were excited, much more excited than Lamorak himself. A dozen times they asked him if he was serious. Lamorak had not shaved, and he felt sick. "Certainly I'm serious. And any time Ragusnik acts like this, you can always import a substitute. No other world has the taboo, and there will always be plenty of temporary substitutes available if you pay enough." He was betraying a brutally exploited man, and he knew it. But he told himself desperately, except for ostracism, he's very well treated, very well. They gave him the handbooks, and he spent 6 hours reading and rereading. There was no use asking questions. None of the Elsevierians knew anything about the job except for what was in the handbook, and all seemed uncomfortable if the details were as much as mentioned. Maintain zero reading of galvanometer A2 at all times during red signal of the lunge howler, read Lamorak. "Now, what's a lunge howler?" "There will be a sign," muttered Bly. And the Elsevierians looked at each other hangdog and bent their heads to stare at their finger ends. They left him long before he reached the small rooms that were the central headquarters of generations of working Ragusniks serving their world. He had specific instructions concerning which turnings to take and what level to reach, but they hung back and let him proceed alone. He went through the rooms painstakingly, identifying the instruments and controls, following the schematic diagrams in the handbook. "There's a lunge howler," he thought, with gloomy satisfaction. The sign did indeed say so. It had a semicircular face bitten into holes that were obviously designed to glow in separate colors. Why a howler, then? He didn't know. "Somewhere," thought Lamorak, "somewhere, wastes are accumulating, pushing against gears and exits, pipelines and stills waiting to be handled in 50 ways. Now they just accumulate." Not without a tremor, he pulled the first switch as indicated by the handbook in its directions for initiation. A gentle murmur of life made itself felt through the floors and walls. He turned a knob and lights went on. At each step, he consulted the handbook, though he knew it by heart, and with each step the rooms brightened and the dial indicators sprang into motion, and a humming grew louder. Somewhere, deep in the factories, the accumulated wastes were being drawn into the proper channels. A high-pitched signal sounded and startled Lamorak out of his painful concentration. It was the communications signal, and Lamorak fumbled his receiver into action. Ragusnik's head showed, startled, then slowly the incredulity and outright shock faded from his eyes. "That's how it is, then. I'm not an Elsevierian, Ragusnik. I don't mind doing this. But what business is it of yours? Why do you interfere?" "I'm on your side, Ragusnik, but I must do this." "Why, if you're on my side? Do they treat people on your world as they treat me here?" "Not any longer. But even if you are right, there are 30,000 people on Elsevier to be considered."
"They would have given in. You've ruined my only chance."
"They would not have given in. And in a way, you won. They know now that you're dissatisfied. Until now, they never dreamed a Ragusnik could be unhappy, that he could make trouble."
"What if they know? Now all they need do is hire an outworlder any time."
Lamorak shook his head violently. He had thought this through in these last bitter hours. "The fact that they know means that the Elsevierians will begin to think about you. Some will begin to wonder if it's right to treat a human so. And if outworlders are hired, they'll spread the word that this goes on upon Elsevier, and galactic public opinion will be in your favor. And things will improve. In your son's time, things will be much better."
"In my son's time," said Ragusnik, his cheeks sagging. I might have had it now. Well, I lose. I'll go back to the job. Lamorak felt an overwhelming relief. If you'll come here now, sir, you may have your job, and I'll consider it an honor to shake your hand. Ragusnik's head snapped up and filled with a gloomy pride. You call me, sir, and offer to shake my hand. Go about your business, Earthman, and leave me to my work, for I would not shake yours. Lamorak returned the way he had come, relieved that the crisis was over and profoundly depressed, too. He stopped in surprise when he found a section of corridor cordoned off so he could not pass. He looked about for alternate routes, then startled at a magnified voice above his head. Dr. Lamorak, do you hear me? This is Counselor Bly. Lamorak looked up. The voice came over some sort of public address system, but he saw no sign of an outlet. He called out, Is anything wrong? Can you hear me? I hear you. Instinctively, Lamorak was shouting, Is anything wrong? There seems to be a block here. Are there complications with Ragusnik? Ragusnik has gone to work, came Bly's voice. The crisis is over, and you must make ready to leave. Leave? Leave Elsevier. The ship is being made ready for you now. But wait a bit, Lamorak was confused by this sudden leap of events. I haven't completed my gathering of data. Bly's voice said, This cannot be helped. You will be directed to the ship, and your belongings will be sent after you by servo mechanisms. We trust... Something was becoming clear to Lamorak. You trust what? We trust you will make no attempt to see or speak directly to any Elsevierian. And, of course, we hope you will avoid embarrassment by not attempting to return to Elsevier at any time in the future. A colleague of yours would be welcome if further data concerning us is needed. I understand, said Lamorak tonelessly. Obviously, he had himself become a Ragusnik. He had handled the controls that in turn had handled the wastes. He was ostracized. He was a corpse handler, a swineherd, an inside man at the skunk works. He said, Goodbye. Bly's voice said, Before we direct you, Dr. Lamorak, on behalf of the Council of Elsevier, I thank you for your help in this crisis. You're welcome, said Lamorak bitterly.